sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Another record for the S&P 500. Sell in May or stay in play? Fast food bubble approaching? Our guest today, author Michael Covell from Trend Following Investment Research. All this and much more on episode number 413 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello and welcome. Andrew Horowitz here, and it is the Disciplined Investor Podcast for the end of May, or mid, I guess middle May 17th of 2015. Thanks for joining me. We have a great guest that is coming up, someone who hasn't been on the program before, and I'm very much looking forward to talking with him, finding out more about what he has to say about turtle traders, as well as trend following and how that works exactly. I know a lot of you are fans. I got a lot of great tweets that you are happy that we are having him on the show first time. So stick around. We'll have him on shortly. And if you do want to send me a tweet or if you want to follow me, it's Andrew Horowitz, one word, that you can just follow me on Twitter. So we do have another record, another new high for the S&P 500. And this is on the heels of some pretty, I would say, lackluster economic news as well as earnings that have been far from stellar. In fact, as we go through the recent review of the earnings season so far with regards to the S&P 500, we can see that since the beginning, where we saw somewhere around a high 60% beat rate of earnings in EPS and maybe a mid to low 60% on revenue, that has slipped dramatically over the last several weeks. In fact, it has come down progressively down to just about 60% or so for earnings beats. Now, you remember something. One of the big issues here was that we saw that in the beginning of the quarter, and actually just before the beginning of the quarter, where we were going to have earnings come out, so the beginning of an earnings season, and about a month before that, a lot of analysts had dropped their estimates significantly. If you recall, we talked about how there was somewhere around a 5 to 6% drop in earnings on expectations. So what we see now is that companies have been able to beat by a small margin, 1-2 cents here and there, some larger, some companies missing, but a lot of the beats have come on much lower earnings expectations, and I think that's a big sign. In fact, one of the screens that we do and we look at for some of our portfolios, one particular strategy, where we look at about 5,000 different stocks and go through a screen that shows, okay, well, what are the earnings growth rates? What are the revenue growth rates quarter over quarter, last several quarters, looking backwards, looking forwards? What are the margin expansion possibilities for the company? One of the things that we saw was that far fewer stocks actually came through the screen. And that's always a sign that is very concerning because now all of a sudden, for whatever reason, companies are no longer able to meet their, in our opinion, their high growth rates that they've been meeting before. So when we have, for example, a time, just an example, where there's maybe, I don't know, 120 stocks that make it through that screen, and all of a sudden, you start seeing that drop over a period of months from 120 down to 100, down to 75, maybe down to 50, you have to say to yourself, what's going on here? Why aren't companies able to meet the growth parameters of a quality high level that we've been seeing for some time before? Now, this is all part and parcel of when we see a slowdown, but yet at the same time, when I mentioned earlier that the S&P 500 hit a record, what's happening that people, individuals, investors, hedge funds, institutional managers are not looking at this and saying, well, maybe we shouldn't assign such a high multiple to stocks. That's something we need to watch very carefully, because when and if we do see that there is a possible rate hike or maybe even an agreement across the board that the PE multiples and the multiples paid for stocks shouldn't be as high as they are, what's going to happen? What's going to happen is that we're going to see a contraction of PE. We're going to see a contraction of pricing. Unless stocks are able to keep pace with the growth rates that they see and what many of the screens and quantitative analysis that you see on money managers, not just the ETFs that are like the SPY or Qs, not the passive managers, but the active managers that look to these different metrics for the advice of what stocks they need to be looking at, include in their portfolios, et cetera, that could be a big problem. But we'll see what happens. So far, the whole adage of sell in May and go away hasn't played out at all. There was some questionable times recently in the daily movement of markets that you had to say, well, maybe things are starting to play out a little bit, that the idea, well, bonds are starting to go up. We're seeing that yield prices, that is, or prices are going down and yields are going up. Bond yields are going up. There's a pretty much an agreement that the Fed is going to raise rates sometime by the end of the year. And what's going on there? And how is that affecting stocks? Will companies be able to do all the buybacks, the dividends, pay down their debt, refinance, utilize very low-cost debt to do all the things they're doing that have been creating a tremendous amount of buying underneath the surface of the markets? So that's something that we really need to pay attention to right now, and how fast we do see that change from a rate of sub 3%, you know, and a sub 2% for the 10-year, sub 3% for the 30-year, as well as the international bonds. Look what happened with the Bund recently, going from 0.05% yield to 0.75%. Pretty significant. We're going to talk about this. We'll talk about also some stocks to watch. We'll talk about some of the economics to come, as well as the rotation that's going on this year in sectors after we talk with our guests. So why not get right to it? Because I know you are excited about hearing from him. Our special guest today is Michael Covell, and he's a gentleman that you know, you've heard about. He has a very popular podcast. He's an author and a best-selling author of 5 different books. Maybe you know him the best from Trend Following, Learn to Make Millions in Up and Down Markets, as well as The Complete Turtle Trader, How 23 Novice Investors Became Overnight Millionaires. We'll get to talk to him about that. He's an entrepreneur. He teaches trend following to thousands of people around the world, research that helps people achieve financial success, et cetera. And we're talking with him today. So how are you, my friend?
I'm pretty good.
Good. So let's talk a little bit about some of the things that I think many of my listeners who may not have maybe delved deep into who you are and who want to know more about you maybe want to know. I wanted to focus first on the whole thing. I think I first maybe heard about you, or maybe at least my recollection was that I can relate the name of or the phrase turtle trader to you. And I guess the first question is, you know, what's a turtle trader?
It's just the greatest story when it comes to learning a trading technique from somebody else that exists in Wall Street history, at least in my humble opinion. And a very wealthy guy named Rich Dennis, who had made his first $1 million in the mid-1970s trading on the floors in Chicago. And then by the early 1980s, he had made a couple $100 million. Hmm. Was probably the biggest, baddest trader on the planet. And him and his partner, Bill Eckhart, they went to see the old Eddie Murphy, Dan Aykroyd Trading Places movie. They walked out. His partner said, wow, what a great movie. You know, the story takes someone off the street, make him rich and famous, yada, yada, yada. And Rich said, well, we can do that. His partners are like, hold on, how are we going to do that? They made a little bet. They put ads in the paper. They asked for trainees to respond. About thousands of people responded. They hired approximately 20 people. And over the course of right around 4 years, the group of 20 approximately made about $100 million profit. They were taught trend following techniques, and they really gave a lot of weight to the idea of nurture and nature and that debate. And so nurture won in that case.
Hmm. Wow. So this whole idea of taking, I guess the bigger picture we can look at is taking anybody who at least has the desire, the you know, to be involved in this, and teaching them certain techniques, strategies, rules, disciplines can really help them make money in trading the markets. Now, has that changed over the years?
I don't think it's changed, but I think you started to bring something up, which I think is true. If you put trading aside for a second and just talk about any life success, I mean, the vast majority of people aren't going to do it. They're just not going to do it. They're going to hang out on their iPhone. They're going to watch cable news. They're going to talk a mean game, but they're not going to do it. So I don't care what the life success is. I'm sure the old 80-20 thing is following and right on down the line. So I think that's terribly important. So, of course, so if that's the case, can anybody learn? Yes. Does everybody really want to do it? Yeah, probably not.
Well, it's like a diet.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like a diet. You know what you have to do. You know what you have to eat, what you don't have to eat. You know what's going to be bad for you. And, all right, listen, you could cheat a little while, which would be the equivalent of, okay, for a few hours hanging out on the iPhone, not paying attention to what you're doing. But, you know, you got to get back right on the saddle again. And the fact is that it's all about – it comes back all to – the desire, the discipline, and all that. And I guess that's why computers these days are so good at it. If you can teach a computer and design a computer to have an algorithm that can follow a particular set of features that will actually do something, they're not going to take a break.
Yeah, I was watching a video the other day. Jim Simons, Renaissance Technologies. One people probably never heard of him, but he's one of the richest guys in the world. He's made $14 billion for himself, all trading models. And he was asked by a reporter. He said, hey, you know, do you kind of feel bad or, you know, watching the computer do all the work and you're not doing anything and you just sit back and watch, you know, does that feel good for your ego? And he said, what are you talking about? No. And I'm paraphrasing here. He said, look, you know, if you give a, is the chisel the responsibility for making the carpenter good? No, it's just a tool.
Yeah.
And a computer's a great tool to get all of the human biases out of the equations, all those, the reasons why Daniel Kahneman won his Nobel Prize. The computer helps to fight human nature.
Which can be very destructive. Emotions, of course, play an important part of all this, and it can be very destructive and usually is when it comes to markets and, you know, when it comes to money, of course, and your safety and your own personal security, financial security, that is, I guess. So you interviewed about 23 of the various traders on that. Now, were they all successful?
No. And that'll fall the same way. But I will say this, though, for the vast majority of them, they absolutely were, and I think six today still trade for clients.
Wow.
So this experiment ended in 1988. This is only 4 years, and then they all went out on their own.
Wow.
And did exceptionally well. And there's actually stories where traders learn from them and then have gone on to have super successful careers. So, and then if you extrapolate that out and you look at the London hedge fund scene, yes, not affiliated with the Turtles, but the London trend following traders that came from AHL and Man, and now it's gone into Aspect and Winton. Maybe names people don't know, but it's another one of these stories where the legacy and the teaching and the rules just kept moving forward with other people applying them.
Right. So what is, now you mentioned trend following. This is something that you teach, something you wrote a book about, something that's all a part of this. Can you give us, you know, from the very basic, you know, I know nothing. I'm pre-turtle, egg. What is trend following?
Well, it starts with the idea that none of us can predict tomorrow. So if you can't predict tomorrow and you have a sneaky suspicion that fundamental analysis doesn't exactly do what people think it does, regardless of how many successful stories are popped out, like a Warren Buffett, and I salute Warren Buffett. He's made a fortune, but there's only one. There's only one.
Mm-hmm.
And so trend following is about saying, okay, if all the fundamentals and all this news and all this noise isn't really useful to making money, what can we use to make money? Well, you can look at the markets themselves. You can look at the price action. You can look at the movement of the price. For example, look at crude oil in 2014. Basically drops 50%.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody was predicting that, right? But if you had a trend following system that was going short on something simple like a moving average or a breakout, you took that short position. You don't know anything about OPEC. You don't know anything about what's going on in global macroeconomic whatever, but you're just short. And at the end of the year, you wake up and that market's gone down 50%. And that particular market would have carried you through. So the idea is not unlike people have seen the blackjack videos and stuff. I mean, like, for example, the MIT blackjack team. This is all about finding an edge. So if you're going to just trade trends, if you're going to say, I don't know anything. If the market's going up, I want to be long. If the market's going down, I want to be short. And I'm going to have a simple signal that gets me in. I'm going to have somewhat complicated money management because we've all got limited capital. So if you've got limited capital, how much are you going to bet on each trade? And run that through, you're going to end up with 30, 40% winners. Your winners are going to be 3 to 4 times the size of your losers. And you're simply trying to find a small edge that you can bet on. Because if you've got a small edge that you can bet on, you can win in the long run. It's the exact polar opposite of anything and everything that's ever talked about on any financial news channel ever.
Well, the problem is there's nothing to talk about, really. If you think about it, at the end of the day, it's so simple. It can't be so simple that how much time would it take up on a financial news channel? So therefore, you have to stuff it with all the reasons. Now, I think one of the big things here, and I think you'll probably agree with this, is that the reason that there is all the news, the reason that there's such an attraction to that is that we all need to know the reason why. We're all in search for rationale. Why is oil going down? It doesn't matter that it's going down. Why is it going down? Then we can kind of at least say, okay, I understand that. And therefore, I can then trade it in this direction, in this bias, because we don't want to do things oftentimes just simply by following a trend. And I'm speaking generally here. So what happens is that individuals will look for all these reasons, all these ideas, and come up with something. For example, you know, you look at a stock that, again, I'm talking fundamentals for a second, that is undervalued. You know, well, there's a reason why it's undervalued, and you know, it's starting to move lower and it's lower, and it continues to say, quote unquote, undervalued fundamentally. And all these guys are, well, it should start moving higher because of this, and there's a catalyst that's doing that and all this. But meanwhile, if you were to follow that and you start buying it and it's still moving down, now you're not following the trend. What you're following is the hopeful idea that it will turn, which it may one day, by the way. But the fact is, maybe that trend isn't exhausted yet.
Yeah, the why part is interesting because at some stage of the game, I think we have to all be a little bit honest with ourselves and say this desperate desire to have the why. Are we at the point in time in 2015 we can say that's delusional? And so then if you bring up the financial news shows, I can say quite simply why they exist. They sell advertising.
Yeah.
And the people that come on their shows are selling a book of some sort, a financial book. I mean, their book of money management firm, et cetera, et cetera. And look, we all sell something. We all sell something. Right. I'm selling something. You sell something.
Yep.
We all sell something. The question is it an honest sell? That's the real thing that drives me.
Well, the thing that's funny is that I don't know if you've noticed this because, you know, I keep the, news. I look at news. I look at just various things during the day just to kind of feel what's happening, stay in touch with what's happening, of course. And I find that when I start looking at whether it doesn't matter the station, but everybody's saying the same thing, which may not be associated to what is actually happening. But everybody is, I guess, at this point, so worried about being wrong that everybody is consensus on everything. There's few outliers.
That's another issue, too, when you talk about, if you're talking about the professional money management world, there's a lot of career risk. I mean, folks are paid a lot of money to look like their neighbor. And so if they don't look like their neighbor, I mean, they're not even attempting to do the right thing for their clients' money. They're just attempting to keep their job. And keeping their job is if my other neighbor fund manager is down 10%, well, if I only go down 9 or 10%, then I'm okay. And I'm looking at it saying, hold on, you're both down 10%. You're both bad.
Yep. No, I agree. It's kind of interesting that, you know, taking that risk of being out of the market, you know, being, forget about being short for a second, but being out of the market is almost like it's heresy and it's absolute, it is the polar opposite of job security. But I want to get into a little bit more about trend following and, you know, a couple of different questions. So what's a screening process that you use? You know, because we could talk all day long about, oil. Okay, great. Well, how did you find oil? You know, it doesn't just appear on your screen as, okay, there it is, and it's starting to move lower or higher. How do you screen and what do you look for? Is there a specific amount of names that you look at? Where does that universe come from?
The universe is going to be your global liquid markets. And we're talking all different asset classes, from bonds to currencies to metals, you know, to cocoa to coffee to oil. So you want to have this diversity on your screen, so to speak. And so that diversity can be traded. I tell people you can trade it in one of three ways, really. You can trade futures markets, you can trade ETFs, you can trade LEAPS options. But you need to have leverage. I mean, leverage is such a great tool at your disposal. We're not talking crazy over leveraged, et cetera, but no, leverage with a plan. So you want to have that, this tracking portfolio, so to speak. So let's say you're following anywhere from, and it's going to be different strokes, different folks, let's say 25 to 100 markets. So instead of sitting around and worrying about whether or not, you know, there's millions and millions of issues around the world, you're looking for the biggest, most liquid markets, and you're tracking those. And you're considering that tracking portfolio that you follow for your personal account. You're looking at it through a correlation lens, and you're saying, okay, let's, what we're going to track here, let's look at the correlation in advance. So we're not, I mean, look, if you were just to trade a trend following portfolio across 25 tech names that we could pull out of Silicon Valley, they're going to move lockstep up and down together. There's no diversification.
Right.
I mean, diversification is still the old adage. It's one of the only free lunches you have. You have to take it. So it really starts from there. That's the initial starting point, is narrow the field down and get some diversity. Check that correlation. Now you're waiting for signals.
And when you get those signals is when you pounce, we'll say, lack of a better word.
You're taking a long or a short position. I mean, you're directional agnostic here. There's right. Absolutely no reason you should care whether you're making money either up or down on a market. I mean, you're a speculator. We're all speculators. I mean, that's actually anyone that ever says something bad about speculation, just, you know, turn off that TV.
Right. The word manipulation is a bad word. Speculation is just part and parcel of the whole process.
Yeah, speculation is a beautiful word.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful word.
But do you now, I mean, one of the things I always tell people, or I think to myself too, is, you know, sometimes, hey, just turn a chart upside down, back and forth, and then don't even look at the numbers, and which way would you go? This way you turn off the whole short, long concept in terms of bias.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't even look at a chart. Why do you need a chart? I mean, think about it. If you were on a desert island and all you had was price quotes coming across some old-fashioned ticker tape, and you didn't even know the names of those markets, but you just had, you know, you had 30 series of quotes coming in every day, and all you have is a closing signal. At some stage of the game, and your infinite boredom sitting on that island, could you find a pattern? I mean, this goes square against the efficient market hypothesis orthodoxy. I mean, this is everything against the University of Chicago. I mean, anyone that's still talking about the markets being efficient, they're just drinking Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
So, you know, can you find that pattern that you can bet on? Is there a small edge that you can bet on? And then once you've got that edge that you can bet on, you know, almost rooted in the old Kelly criteria theorem, what's the optimal bet that you can make?
So if you don't use charts, now you say you don't use charts, or you're just not...
What are they for?
I don't know. You define the particular trend to see visually, just to visually see the trend. No?
Well, okay, but you're making your judgment, you're making your signal, you're taking your entry or your exit off something very straightforward, like a moving average or a breakout.
Okay.
So if you're trading off that, then the chart is just there to fool you in some ways.
So talking about a breakout, because I'm a little bit confused, talking about a breakout, how do you know what the breakout is if you don't have a chart to look at the pricing where the breakout happens?
Well, if you just got a series of prices, you just got a vertical column in Excel, and you're saying, okay, what's the highest high of the last 200 closing day prices.
Right.
And now I've just hit that. And so the market, whatever market it might be, it doesn't really make a difference, because we don't need to even know the names of these markets. And if anybody out there thinks that that sounds entirely crazy, it's not. It's absolutely just a brilliant piece of trading strategy that was developed. Gosh, people argue it's been developed back to a guy named David Ricardo in the 1700s. Jesse Livermore doing versions of it, Richard Donchian putting the first trend following fund out in the 1950s. It's just something, if you haven't heard of it, you just haven't heard of it, but that doesn't make it not viable.
And these are things obviously you teach in your courses. You have a course that you teach on trend following, giving people all the tools, strategies, and all the indications of, hey, this is kind of the setups, this is what you want to be looking for, and this is what you teach, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, through a combination of ways. I mean, there's the free ways. There's the podcast with some of the best traders in the planet. There's the books. And then there's additional training for people that need even more handholding. Absolutely.
Now, a couple of other just follow-up questions on this. Over the last several years with this zero interest rate environment, and this may or may not be, this may just be kind of like, well, no, obviously we're not even paying attention. But with the changes in central bank activity, and the change in liquidity of markets, has that changed anything at all in terms of the difficulty in finding profitable trades at all?
Well, 2014 was a banner year. 2008 was a banner year. And there was probably mixed years in between. But those banner years, 2008, 2014, there was many professional trend following traders that posted, you know, 100% returns. So, yeah, there's going to be choppy periods. You're not going to always have what you want, so to speak. And there's no doubt about it that trend following returns, given that most trend following traders produced double-digit returns in October of 08. And so there's no doubt about it that when the government decided that we were going to take actions to benefit certain groups in early 2009, that wasn't the best move for trend following traders. But then again, you can't control that.
Well, and actually, it's interesting. If I may interject, it's interesting you mentioned that because in theory, you know, obviously, this makes sense though. But you know, with trend following, you need to have a trend that is longer than 5 minutes. You know, in terms of it has to have a little bit of gusto with, and that's why I can imagine that back in some of those years that you saw that there was a trend that followed through that was a continuum. Obviously, that wasn't just a chop, if you will, like a false breakout or false breakdown. Obviously, those are where the trend following doesn't necessarily work, depending on your time period, right? Depending on the time frame. But I could see that clearly when there are those trends, and that's where probably, for example, in some of those years that we just saw that a couple times, you know, chop just back to zero, chop back to zero, chop back to zero. That's not a, you can make money there, but that's not going to be a banner situation, right?
Heavy central bank intervention is, I'll argue, is not good for anybody. It's definitely not good for trend following traders typically.
Right.
And I don't know how a heavy central bank intervention is great for just the average guy with a buy and hold portfolio, because as we've seen in the last 15 years, that usually sets people up for a fall.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if I remember back in 2008 where, you know, or 2000, let's go before that, 2006, 2007, you know, we got back to, oh, buy and hold's the only way. And then everybody gets spooked out and trending, trading. And in and out, going long, short, whatever it was a much better play. And buy and hold guys were kind of like, you know, picking up their wares and kind of with their heads down and going, oh man, is it going to come back? And then obviously we look back where we've seen such a rise over the last number of years with a couple of little valleys in there, but a continuation of just, you know, buy the dip. Any dip is good to buy, and whatever reason is going to be in terms of just looking straight at the values of equity indices, you know, different when it comes to commodities, that buy, you know, the guys back on the mutual fund wagon, ETFs, buy and hold, absolutely nothing else in between, are like, oh, see, we told you, if you just hung on, you would have been fine. And it kind of, and I agree with you, it puts a level of complacency into investors that, you know, they kind of forget about what happened. I mean, investors have a very short term, you know, the average investor, a very short-term memory for a lot of things, you know, and that may be a year, let's say. And when they get back, they're like, well, okay, well, don't worry about it. We're never going to go short. We're never going to sell again. Don't you find that happening?
Yeah. I just think it's unusual that when you, I guess it's not unusual, but when you have these 5 or 6 year periods where everything goes well in equities, and you, we all know that a certain amount of what's going on in equities is central bank rigging, is the nicest way to say it, then at some point in time, things have to revert. And we've seen the reversion twice in the last 15 years. And I just think people aren't prepared for it again. And for the life of me, if someone's not imagining, if you're just a buy and hold investor right now, I'm not trying to scare you, but you should be prepared for another 50% decrease at some point in time in the future. It surely will happen. I can't tell you when. I can't make a prediction. Nobody can make a prediction. But if you're not prepared for that worst case scenario, if you're not thinking that through, you surely don't want to wake up in retirement years and just saying to yourself, well, gosh, I just trusted the Fed and they were going to take care of me. And then one day they don't take care of you.
I guess what happens is that it becomes a more and more difficult concept the longer things go in a particular direction to stay agnostic on the short long. That's the point, right? So what happens is that you get this feeling that, well, you know what? I'm not going to go short ever again. Again, not your average person that's trained, disciplined, and all that. I'm talking about the you know, your retail trader or your mutual fund holder that is absolute. They're like, well, you know what? I'm just not going to do it. You know, and they lose that perspective.
But a trend following portfolio is not going to be just about, let's say, one particular index or one particular market in short.
Right.
It's going to be having a strategy where you say, I will take whatever comes in terms of signals. Okay, I get a long signal, a long breakout, or I get a short breakout or a moving average that goes for the downside. I'm taking that. And I'm not, and there's got to be diversification there, because you're right. If you find yourself in a situation where you're literally having a battle within yourself about whether you're going to be long or short the S&P or something like that, just one, that's the only thing on your screen. Well, gosh, get rid of all the stress, buy Buffett, just go long, and don't do anything. Just you drive yourself crazy doing that.
Yeah, just go play golf.
Yeah, go fishing. I mean, just take it from, instead of having this philosophical debate like we're having about whether the Fed is good or bad or this or that and what happens and all these alternate strategies, if you don't want any stress, just go play golf. You know that you're going to get some 50% clips if you're a buy and hold trader. And know in the long term that even though things might look really exciting in the moment, and my gosh, I look at what's going on in China right now. Everyone thinks they're going to get super rich. Everyone just, you can see the 1999 parallel for America. And, you know, if you know in the long run, it's not going to work out that way. And the law of averages are going to bring all those massive equity gains on paper back down while you're playing golf. It's a choice. It's a choice. It's a way to live.
And my point of bringing this up is not, and just this is a very good point, I think, not to debate whether or not it's good or bad what the Fed did and how it will play out, but the concept of understanding that what the Fed is doing is what the Fed is doing, what the markets, and when I say the markets, I'm talking about all the markets, whether it's ags, whether it's equity indices, bond indices, it doesn't matter. They're doing what they're doing, and to try to disassociate the fact of what the Fed is doing today, or what you think they're going to do tomorrow, or what they say they're going to do tomorrow, by the way, and look at the bigger picture. Okay, what is happening, to bring it back to the concept? Because I believe in the idea of using, I call it technicals, but trend following concepts as a part of your buy sell disciplines. I think it's very wise, and I think that we want to bring it back and make sure people understand that as a core part of what they're doing, and don't get wrapped up in all this. But the point is that, you know, discussing all the Fed and discussing this again is still, even that we are discussing it, at the end of the day, you're going to go back and say, that's great. It was a great discussion, but
regardless of what happens, you have to have a plan. And even for those individuals out there that are saying, oh, I like this guy, Mike, he's talking about how bad the Fed is and da-da-da-da-da, and that means I'm going to buy gold now. That's just as bad. That's not a plan either.
right.
That's not a plan. You know? You can't go, the end timers thing is not a plan.
Yep.
You know, so it's almost like you need to draw that map, that schematic out on your desk and say, what are the valid strategies out there that I can employ? How much time will they take me to execute? What do I want over the course of a lifetime? And then that's it.
Yep. And by the way, the other thing, and I think this is an add-on to what you just said, is that if you had a predisposition to gold and you were thinking that, oh, gold is going to go up eventually. Oh, I like what that guy Michael said. He confirmed my thoughts on gold. I'm going to buy gold.
Right.
Right. You know, using.
I didn't say that, but you know what? Some people will probably think they heard that.
Right. Exactly. So the thing is, be careful of your predispositions for something, which is again the polar opposite of what we're talking about here, which is, you know, clear the deck on a regular basis. Have a sign up in your office. You know, today is a new day, and today may or may not be a new trend, and it doesn't matter what I think. Just look at the raw numbers and look at the trend. End of sentence.
Here's another way to think about the Fed discussion. So instead of making it seem like a criticism, so if a government intervenes, they're taking some steps, they're taking some actions to do something where the markets might not otherwise go themselves. And they can do that for a long time, and they can push things and extend things like a rubber band. And you can conceptually think ahead 10 years and see how those rubber bands will get stretched and then break and stretch and then break. And if you know that stretching and breaking is part of what we are going to face, what you're going to face in your lifetime, again, you just have to say, what type of strategy do I want to employ if that's the hand that we've been dealt, and what kind of return do I want to target?
Yep. Well, we're talking with Michael Covell. Again, you can find his books on Amazon, The Complete Turtle Trader. trend following, learn to make millions in up or down markets. Of course, his very popular and well done podcast available on iTunes and other various podcast networks, as well as the fact you can check him out. We'll have his website, all his information about how to look at the how to find the trend following investment research and all the strategies available that he has on this this episode's show notes. So check that out, and we'll make sure to tweet it out. So thanks for joining me. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Andrew. Fun. Right.
Talk good to stuff. You. Thanks. See bye-bye. You, I thought that was a pretty good discussion. Interesting talking about the fact that really don't pay attention to much of the news, don't pay attention to some of the fundamentals, just look at the trend. There's some truth in that. Now, we take a little bit of a different tact and we look at some of the quantitative and fundamentals and then look at the stocks themselves, make sure that they have what it takes in terms of a general trend. But there's sometimes that you actually want to look at some of the trends and look at it a contrarian basis too, that we believe that may be very beneficial, because a lot of companies have been thrown out in the garbage and nobody wants to buy them. And all of a sudden there's some change in the dynamic. Maybe the fundamentals are still really solid. Maybe we're seeing that there is a sector change. Maybe there's some very important news that has come out. And I'll give you an example of something like that. A company called Trinity Industries, TRN is the symbol. And Trinity Industries is involved in the railroad, we'll call it manufacturing, parts, equipment. And if you think about what's going on right now with much of the news, even before the recent train derailment last week, there was a discussion about the concern about how many derailments there had been when it comes to chemicals and oils, etc. And many of the trains that were not equipped correctly with certain brakes and certain other safety materials and precautions that were available on the actual cars themselves was put into question. And there was a law signed, I guess about a week ago, 2 weeks ago, that made for some safety precautions and equipment to be put on the trains. Now, look what happened to Trinity Industries. Since they are a major supplier of this, we saw that the company actually had a nice boost in their overall share price. Now, Trinity Industries stock chart looks a little bit, well, not great. But when you look at the fundamentals inside of Trinity Industries and you look at the growth factors of their earnings and you look at their revenue and their margins, you look at what's gone on historically from a company with their overall balance sheet, very solid company, great company. I mentioned this, as a matter of fact, on my podcast that I was the guest with Frank Curzio, I think about a week ago or so, and I mentioned Trinity Industries, and right after that, it just so happens that all this news started coming out. I wasn't privy to this news. I was just talking about the company itself that looked like it was poised for an interesting upside move as it hit support and as the company is a very solid company, and lo and behold, it popped up very nicely. But if you look at the actual fundamentals of Trinity and what they do and dovetail that into much of what is going on right now with regard to the rails and the news that you have seen probably over the weekend that is just everywhere about what's going on, the safety requirements and the new laws that have been put into place for braking systems, as well as a variety of other safety mechanical devices that have to be used. Trinity Industries is right front and center of that particular news item. This is going to be a company that is going to probably reap a lot of benefits if all this goes into actual law and sticks. Because already they're, you know, the train companies are fighting this. They say, well, you know, if we have to do this, even though it is important to have safety, the fact is that it's really going to hurt our revenues. It's going to really hurt our net incomes, et cetera, et cetera. We'll have to take trains offline. We're going to have to pay a lot more money. Okay, that's great. But you know what? I think that maybe it makes sense that we do have some of these laws put into place because, you know, we're seeing a lot. Listen, last week we saw three different train items, right? We saw two derailments. We saw the Amtrak. We saw two in Pennsylvania, as a matter of fact, issues that came up, and one in Milwaukee, a train fire, which I'm not sure what the source of that was and the reason for that. But we saw two derailments. One was a passenger train and one was a non-passenger train, for lack of a better word, and it was a cargo train. And basically, you had two derailments, and that's a big concern. Obviously, the loss of life is a major issue. And in order to provide a very high level of safety, well, again, take a look at it. TRN, something to think about. Okay, a couple of things I want to talk about. Hey, so one of the things that I thought was really interesting was what we're seeing with regard to the sector rotation, or maybe even probably putting it a better way, lack of rotation compared to what we saw last year. Coming to the fourth quarter, we saw that utilities were really just not doing well. We saw healthcare was doing well. Some consumer discretionary technology was doing really well at the end of the year. Oil, energy-related names in the in stocks weren't doing well, and we also saw that banks weren't doing well. Well, let's take a look at the list in order of what is, from top to bottom, playing this year. And the story is pretty much the same. We see the utilities are down 6% this year. Financials are down 0.12%. Industrials up 0.94%. And energy is up 1.9%. Now, if we go to the opposite end, just the best of the best this year to date, we're seeing that healthcare is up 8.5%. And these are all based on the ETFs that track the sectors for the S&P 500. Consumer discretionary is up 6%, materials up 6%, home builders up 5.5%, tech up 4.7%, and the S&P itself through SPY is up 3.36% year to date. So what I found was really interesting, we did see in the beginning of the year, just right in the beginning, a turn of all this. We saw that there was a change. Oftentimes, one quarter or 1 month or 1 year to 1 year, whatever period of time, you do see this rotation that a lot of the better and best run of a sector. So you see the best of the best has been starting to sell off, and they'll rotate that into the worst. And this goes on for a little while, and then we start seeing the reversion to the mean kind of trade come in. We see that the rotational trade starts to come in a little bit, but that's not really happening right now. Well, it happens from time to time in the beginning of the month, maybe. Well, by the end of the month, everything switches over. And this is in the face of a much changing dynamic when it comes to bonds and currencies. The dollar hit, a 5-week or 6-week low recently. We saw that the euro has been really popping up. So has the yen, gaining some strength, which is very interesting. Even in the face of Mario Draghi saying that quantitative easing, that they're gonna just keep on going, keep on trucking through this quantitative easing program, that they're going to exhaust everything that they had planned on doing, because what's happening is that even though we're seeing a little bit of an uptick in the economics in Europe, well, one of the things that has been helping that has been the fact that the euro has been really dropping significantly over the last number of months. And as we are seeing all of a sudden a turn to that and the euro is starting to move higher, that's a problem. The euro is getting close to 115. That's a big move on that currency in the last few weeks. So keep an eye on the rotation. I think that if there is any kind of market blow-off here due to whatever the reason may be, concern about maybe a strengthening U.S., maybe the fact that the euro is continuing to move higher, bond yields are moving higher, safety is going to be a question, and probably you'll see the financials start to pick up, utilities start to pick up, possibly even the industrials. The energy complex is so reliant on the price of oil, which, by the way, is up probably close to almost 45% from the low it hit recently. Crude oil, where is it now? Let's see. Crude oil trading at about $60.75 to be exact at the close of business on Friday. And we did see it even spike a little bit higher because the inventory number that came out last week on Wednesday, the official inventory number, 10:30 in the morning on Wednesdays, was showed an actual drawdown of 1.5 million barrels of oil. That's after we saw, you know, as high as 12 million barrels of a build. 12 million build down to a 1.5 million draw. That's a significant change. And a lot of people have been calling for, you know, oil in the 20s and 30s when it was in the 40-something. Well, it really got sideswiped. In fact, that many of the things that we're seeing right now is a short squeeze, or a short cover for that matter, because many of the hedge funds and speculators on the area of oil had been short. So now the trend changes, as we've talked about with Michael Covell, and all of a sudden the trend changes, and you know, you have to switch to the other side. And that's been going out and playing out pretty significantly. As for economics, let's take a look at what's going on next week. One of the things we did see last week was that the PPI came in pretty soft. In fact, I tweeted early on Thursday morning that the way the pre-market futures were acting, whereas we saw a pretty significant pop at about 4 a.m., actually closer to 3:30. when you look at the chart and you look backwards, I like to look at what's happened overnight, because oftentimes you'll see that the open of the European markets really have a lot of significance on the U.S. futures. That happens at about 4 a.m. Now, I did see an interesting pop about maybe 5 or 6 points on the S&P 500 futures on Thursday. And I'm starting to think about that. And pre-market, I realized that one of the things that was happening was the idea and the theory was, well, we're going to see a very low PPI. Wholesale inflation is probably going to be very soft, and a good jobs number through the initial claims number. That would make the most sense as to why, and I'm not even suggesting there was a leak or anything like that, but that would make sense as to why we're seeing a significant amount of movement from the S&P futures on Thursday. And sure enough, what happened was exactly that, actually. So whether or not my thesis was right or something else was going on, I'm not quite sure. But basically, that the PPI came in pretty light, probably down, if you stretch it out, about 0.3 on the negative side versus a point plus two or so. And that is a pretty soft PPI number. One of the reasons you're seeing that, of course, is the dollar had been a lot higher. And as a dollar is higher and import prices drop, right? Export prices go up with a higher dollar, but import prices drop. What you did see was that the wholesale side of things, where the manufacturing cost, really dropped significantly. Now, coming up next week, we're going to see if that actually played forward to CPI. The expectation is for CPI to be about 0.2 on the core, when it's about the same as last time. So if that is the case, and if we are seeing about a 0.2 consistently, the good news is that that's good for manufacturers and companies that are taking those unfinished goods and then selling them, because they can keep up with inflation by pushing out prices that are higher or at least the same, whereas their prices and input prices are lower. That's always a good thing. We're also going to see the NAHB Housing Market Index on Monday. This is the essentially the consumer confidence, but for builders. What is the builder's confidence? Even though this has a pretty much a high trading impact, I always question whether or not we could really believe just a very small amount of companies putting in their inputs into the survey as to actually what their sentiment is, and if they're actually something that we can statistically say is relevant from this number. We have housing starts on Tuesday at 8:30 and building permits. The forecast is for about 975,000 to about 1 million overall. Prior was 926 on the housing starts. Building permits, about 1 million. Then Wednesday, we're going to see the crude inventories. Minutes from the FOMC meeting. Of course, that's always going to be a market-moving event. And we'll see that at 2 o'clock on Wednesday. Thursday, initial claims, continuing claims, existing home sales, Philly Fed, and leading indicators. The Philly Fed is expected to be about 8.0. Last month, it was about 7.5. Initial claims are expected to be still continuing to see about 265,000, extremely low levels, meaning that hiring has been very strong. And that's something that we're watching very carefully. It's kind of interesting that we're seeing some areas continue to be soft in terms of around the country, Texas and much of the upper Midwest, due to some of the oil sector. Retail also has been laying off, but yet initial claims have been pretty solid. And our jobless rate at 5.4% that we saw, and plus 200,000 on that side of the new jobs added, pretty good. So what we're seeing is an environment that we have much better economic areas that are coming in, or economic indicators that are coming in on jobs, unemployment. But the manufacturing has been rather soft. So it's kind of a weird scenario, right? You would think that if manufacturing is soft, well, what's going on with the jobs? How are they so strong? But it is holding up pretty well. And Friday is the CPI number. So we're going to see all that play out next week. That's kind of important. The other thing that's going to be playing out next week that I think that we really need to keep our eye on, something that we've talked about many times before, is this whole area of Greece. Now, it seems that on the 21st, they're going to have their final meeting. I laugh because there's been so many final meetings and absolute times where they're going to, this is the last time, this is the last meeting, this is when they're going to make a decision, this is when they're going to have some kind of agreement that will be formed and blah, blah, blah. And this is the fifth or sixth or seventh time this year already that the deadline that is going to be. Now, one of the things that Greece has done has been an incredible procrastinator and and instilled so much potential optimism and at the same time pessimism for their plan, and using stall tactics that have to go down in history of the ultimate in stall tactics in negotiations. Now, clearly, one of the things that we are seeing is that there is nobody that really wants a Greece exit, aside from possibly Greece, but I would still say that they are not inclined or in favor of leaving the euro either. It's going to cost them a lot of money. It's going to put them into an instant depression. It's going to remove the ability for them to have cross-border trade as easily as they have now. Unemployment will spike. I mean, just all sorts of problems. Bonds will be worthless. Now, we found a really interesting chart that talked about the about 312 billion euros in debt as of the end of March that GDP Greece is holding. That's about 175% of the country's 2014 GDP, pretty high. Now, who owns that? Well, one of the things that out of the 312, 130 billion euros is from the EFSF, which is that emergency fund that is used to fund countries. Remember that whole thing that was put into place in order to fund many of the European countries? Well, about 130 billion. Then we have, on top of that, about 66 billion in bonds. So only that's all they have in bonds, which is really interesting, right? The rest of it you'll see here is outstanding IMF credit, about 21 billion. Bilateral loans from other euro area countries, 52 billion. Some bonds that are held by euro area central banks, 7.3 billion. Bonds held by the ECB, another 19 billion. And about $39 billion of bonds held privately. And then we finish it off with some short-term repo lending, about 9.8, and other debt like Bank of Greece and EIB, et cetera, about 16.5. But clearly overwhelming if you look at the various loans from European countries, euro area central banks, and ECB. We're talking about 200 billion of the 312 billion euros that is held in debt. And that is the debt that they're looking to refinance. That is the debt that, if there is a Greek exit, will be, obliterated. And you got to think about it. The ECB doesn't want that to happen. If they take a loss on these EFSF loans, the European Financial Stability Fund, if they have losses that they take with this, it will create a major problem for their credit rating and a major problem when we look at the loans that could be made in the future and who can fund those loans, what countries can actually participate in that fund in the future. It would create a major problem and suction like you've never seen of money that will come out of the entire eurozone. Now, that may be beneficial for the euro because it would drop the euro down significantly. But other than that, it really casts a major shadow on the ECB and the plan that they had and what they're doing in terms to reinvigorate and to backstop the countries such as Greece, Spain, Portugal, and maybe even Italy. This is a big issue. I can't imagine that they would allow for an exit of Greece rather than just a simple write-down of interest rates, not a write-down of the debt, but a write-down of the interest rates, because then they could still keep on the books that these are good loans. These are good loans they put out there and therefore not have any blemish on their overall structure. Now, we have a small investment in the National Bank of Greece, and its current price is probably right about where we bought it, give or take. I think that we're a little bit positive on it. And the idea here is that if, in fact, Greece stays within the euro, and even if there is some consideration given to some of the bonds, possibly a haircut here or there, but mostly the fact that they stay within the euro and that they will continue getting funding, that this can be an opportunity that we've, a tremendous return on this in the near future. Now, whether or not this May 21st date is actually going to be the final and the period of time that we can really target as getting some answers, I can't tell you, because even though that is the deadline that is imposed, I don't know. What can I tell you? Yeah, it did. Maybe not. But they've been plowing along this far, and who knows if they, somehow come up magically with a time period of June 15th. We're close. We have a framework. The old framework is probably going to come out. The word framework will be there somewhere when they talk about what's going on. Let's see what else I have to talk about. Last thing I want to talk about. So we have Greece we talked about. The idea of selling May not playing out, although Tom McClellan had a really great piece this week in his daily updates. It talked about how he looks at from all the different factors of advancers and decliners, trends, where the market's playing out, volume, etc., that we should see a very significant drop this week coming up, actually. Now, his market timing models come with a bottom somewhere, I think it's the 19th through the 20th or 18th through the 20th or so. So sometime Tuesday, Wednesday, somewhere around there, he's looking for a pretty major drop. He's bullish long-term, but he's very bearish short-term. And I wonder if some of the inclination and indications of what we've seen of markets and how they played out with lower volume, a bit of a tepid move to the upside in terms of overall strength, is going to fall apart a little bit. And maybe some of that will be due to the news that we're going to see in Europe, or possibly it's going to be something to do with the bonds, and we'll see the trend continue where bond yields move higher. But so far, sell in May and go away hasn't played out as it has many times in the past. And I think that has to do with the fact that once you start getting a greater amount of people that are buying into any particular adage, whether it's the January effect, whether it's sell in May and go away, whether it's Christmas rally, whatever it may be, oftentimes you see that it doesn't work. We talk about that a lot on the DH Unplugged show. And by the way, I don't know if you listened in, but we did broadcast the DH Unplugged show at 10 o'clock at night Tuesday last week live on Periscope. It was kind of fun. We had a good amount of people that joined in, and we may do that this week. We're going to try to see if we can set up a streaming server and see if that works out. Do you have any comment on that? Of course, if you'd like the streaming, if you haven't done it, the Periscope app is available on the Apple Store, and it's available right now. And I don't think it's out for... I know it's available for the iPhone right now on the iPhone OS. I don't think it's available yet for Android, but it's coming out soon from what I understand. But if you did enjoy that, let me know. Send an email to me, askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And finally, we're going to just talk about the fast food bubbles. I find it very interesting. If you look at some of the stock pricing and trends and recent action on companies like Chipotle, Pollo Loco, you look at even Shake Shack, which was up about 15% on its earnings number and then came down to about down 5% the day after, or that day, the day of the actual market when it was open during actual market hours, not the after hours markets, after they released earnings. Stock was down pretty significantly. Did a nice pop up about 7% or so the day after, but I still do question, what's going on with these fast food companies? Now we got Bojangles out there. Look at Jack in the Box. What's going on there? Seems to me that there's something going on that is behind the scenes and not doing as well. It could be to the fact that the food costs are up. It could be the fact that there's just too much competition out there right now, too many choices, and we're just flooded with these opportunities, and you have to spread out the actual earnings and revenues to all these different companies out there. But something is going on that I think should be watched. So keep a watch on the fast food companies, and we're going to wrap it from there. I hope you enjoyed the show. I hope you listen and subscribe. Make sure to tell your friends. Follow me on Twitter, Andrew Horowitz. Emails, askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Check out Aero Strategy, which is essentially a trend following strategy, looking for significant breaks on the trend and overbought and oversold indications. We do that with the S&P 500. If you want to check that out, $50,000 minimum, we manage it for you. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Right on the page to the right there, you'll see a little arrow blinking banner. Just click that and get more information about all sorts of things about it, as well as our other strategies. That's what we're here for, to help you manage your money as well at Horowitz Company. So if you want any information, just come on and ask. All of that is available right on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Well, thanks a lot. Have a great weekend, and I'll see you next week.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented and should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.